Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Normally when you hear that, that's the sound of anger. That's the bumper music that indicates there's anger in the air. But I don't know that there's anger in the air. We've been talking about this for a while. So much news over the weekend about the signing of the Afghan peace deal, whatever the hell that is. So naturally joining me are our expert international commentators, Jeff Kenny and Tim Lynch. Tim joining us from Texas. Tim, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing fine, Mac. Thank you.
All right, Jeff. Jeff's been actually in Florida, seeing his mother. So being, of all things, a good son. So, exactly. So, Jeff, what's going on?
Nothing. As you say, I'm in Florida. It's my mom's birthday, and you know we're celebrating it by supporting All Marine Radio.
Now, we're actually recording this, and Jeff's at home doing this. And where's your mom?
They just got back from Mass, so they're being quiet in the other room. I'm in a bedroom. I'm in one of the spare bedrooms right now.
So there you go. Just mom just got back from Mass. So in the state of grace. Tell me about your mom, Jeff. What was your mom like?
She was born in 1934, so she's 86 today. And she was born in Brooklyn, New York. And they moved to Connecticut in December of 1940. My grandmother had 11 kids, 5 boys, 6 girls. And my mom was dead in the middle. And she went to nursing school at Catholic educational nursing school in Hartford. And she was an RN for God up until the 80s. She ended up 20 years as a head nurse in a coronary intensive care unit at Hartford Hospital. And then she retired, and my dad passed away in 2013. So she's just been our matriarch. She's known as being a tough lady. And visiting here also is her younger brother, Vinny DePasquale, who lives in Long Island now, who's one of two boys were older than her, but 3 of them were younger than her, Vinny, Bobby, and Tommy, and she basically raised them. So Uncle Vinny and his Aunt Carol are here, and we're just going to help my mom. I think we're going to go to Outback and, celebrate this. But she's very
– I love Outback.
She thought Ford was a pussy for pulling out of Vietnam. That's my mom.
Yeah. Tell us about – what kind of parent was your mom?
Hard.
Was she?
Yeah, she was her and my dad worked full-time. My dad started out as like a worker for Pratt & Whitney and Colt Firearms and stuff in Connecticut. But he eventually went to school, and he became a respiratory therapist. And he did good doing that job. He got to be a supervisor in Yale New Haven Hospital, which is down in New Haven, Connecticut, which is like 40 miles south of Hartford. And so they were both tired all the time and pissed off. And, and when they come together at dinner and, but they were very, very good, very good parents, dedicated to us, me and my 2 brothers and sister, and she still is, but, I was kind of hard to handle, I guess. I was the oldest boy, the oldest kid. And so when I said, I want to join the Marine Corps, they said, yeah, we figure,
we figured you'd want to do something brilliant like that.
So they made me she made me graduate high school before they'd sign. So I graduated in June 21st of 75, and I joined the Marine Corps the next day.
Paris Island. You could imagine all the stories that when there was stories written about the Marine Corps in the 70s, none of them were good. Okay. And now your genius of a son comes to you and says, what? Hey, I want to join them. And she's just like, this stupid son of a bitch. Where did I go wrong with him?
All my uncles on my dad's side, there's 4 guys, and on my mom's side, there was 5. All of them were in the service. None of them were in the Marine Corps. All they said was, you want to stay away from that? It's the crappiest things were for me, and plug it in, the Army, the Navy, whatever, you know, it wasn't anything compared to what we saw was going on with those guys. So, you know, but I did it.
Timmy, we've never talked about your mom, Timmy. What was your mom like?
My mom was pretty strict also, but she had a bit of an independent streak. So she would take on projects. I remember for some reason, we were doing some massive restructuring in the backyard in the year that my dad was in Vietnam. And then, but then I uncovered the bones of what turned out to be a horse. I thought it was a dinosaur, and you know, so we're sitting there doing this work. Once we thought we had a dinosaur, my mother starts acting as if we did. She was a delightful in that respect. But she also, by the time I was seventh grade, she became a real estate agent at the exact same time Annapolis real estate went into a boom, and she was making a crap ton of money doing that. Really? And that kept her very busy. So in my later years, before my parents divorced, when they were together, it would be like Jeff said, they're both of them cranky and tired and pissed when they got home. Because at the time, my dad was working in D.C. when he wasn't in Vietnam. We all lived in Annapolis the whole time. He just got up at 4 and went to work then because he didn't want to move.
Interesting. No.
Yeah, one more thing about my mom. Because of her nurse background, she was convinced, I think, that 80% of all young boy problems could be solved by an enema. And so terrorized my three sons. They go, you know, how are you today, young man? I'm fine, Grandma. You don't mind me. And she'd be staring at him like, you know, like Savannah Rola. You know what I mean? She'd be glaring at him. You know, they're like, with friends like Grandma, who needs enemas?
Yeah. Right. You know, that was my mom. That was my mom deal. Corporal Punishment Kathleen, man. My mom, like, I never heard me talk about it, but my mom was no, like, fuck around. She was a wonderful woman, you know, in the way we grew up, right? Our moms, you know, when we were young, our moms were home every day of our lives, right? Yeah. Not like that anymore. But, I mean, for us, you know, I mean, I came home. I did not want to stay in my house, right, for obvious reasons. My mom was there. Nothing good was going to come of that. And so, you know, you change your clothes, you got on your bike, you know, you grab whatever, your baseball glove or your football, and you went and you found your friends and you hung out. But, you know, to defy my mother, I mean, and we got raised, you know, children, you know, will be seen and not heard, right? You didn't go in your mom's living room. Like, I remember looking in that living room like, someday I'm going to go in that motherfucker, and I'm even going to jump on the couch, but probably not while she's walking on the planet, man, because she'll find out. Some way I'll leave evidence. It's like that fucking rearview mirror in the car that I didn't know existed till I was like 17. Like, that's how she saw that shit. Like, and she used to say, I have eyes in the back of my head. And she did. It's like, fuck, man. All I did was I punched her like once, like, and she saw that shit. But my mom was great. I mean, she was a great, and our families were bigger, you know, back then, and they cooked stuff like stew and goulash and stuff that you could take a little bit and feed a bunch of people for it. And there's an art form to that. She smoked cigarettes. She drank Vin Rosé wine. And that's how she did it. But if you want to defy Kathleen, fuck, stand the fuck by, man. She was not having that. She's not having that one second, man. One second.
I can remember as a kid, my mother would lock me out of the house on the weekend. She'd be like, go play. Go do something. Don't come back until it's dark. I mean, dead serious.
You like little homebody, little house mouse?
No. I'm just saying that there were times when she would literally keep us out of the house because we're running in and out and being all crazy and whatnot. But I'm talking about, so we're in what, sixth, seventh grade. So we're talking 10, 11, 12 at that time. I rode my bike all over the city of Annapolis. My mother had no idea where I was at any point during the day, at any time. And she just, you know, she took it by, she just knew that when it gets dark, I'd come home and get dinner. And me and my siblings, we were gone to the four winds. You had no idea where we were.
That's awesome.
And it's so alien now, right. You know, it's just alien.
Right.
Did your dad go to the Naval Academy, Tim?
He did go to the Naval Academy. And that's why we kind of based in Annapolis. So he came back and did a tour as a captain. where one of his favorite students was Jim Webb. One of his least was Ollie North. That's kind of interesting, isn't it? Mm-hmm. He did it as a captain, and then went what the hell? Captain. Then he went to command and staff, and then he went to Vietnam. And we came back to Annapolis when he was in Vietnam. Then he worked at headquarters Marine Corps after that, and we stayed in Annapolis up until the time. Until my parents divorced. And then I ended up in Quantico for high school because I was sent to live with my dad because I was a bit of a delinquent. And that was a deal that that my parents made. Yeah.
Jeff, you never got sent away and you were a bit of a delinquent.
It's true. I got beat a lot, but not as much as I deserved.
Well, that's what I always say. You know, I tell the story of, you know, my mom – you know, beating. And you know what? I brought her on my radio show when I was doing it. And I can't remember what I was fucking with her. Right. And so I started asking her about like spanking me and she like straight up denied it.
She's like, I don't remember.
Wow.
Yeah. She's like a global warming denier. Right. And so, or whatever, a Holocaust denier or whatever denier you want to put my mom into. That was her. And I'm like, I don't even know who you are right now, man. I said, are you kidding me? She's like, Michael, I don't know like why you would say that. And I'm like, are you kidding me, man? You used to. But again, I was like, Jeff, you know, I was fascinated like by fire as a little kid. Like I was an amateur pyromaniac. And I remember I turned the gas on once. I didn't really understand it. And I was under the age of 10. And so I turned the gas on and lit it. But I didn't understand how to shut it off. Right? And so I think I poured water on it and got the flame to go out. So my dad comes in the house, right? And he's like, what's that smell? He's like, why does it smell like gas in here? And I'm like, I don't know. And he goes over the fireplace and he sees water. he opens the front door, right? I'm sure thanking God that like my mom wasn't the first one in smoking her parliaments, right? The whole 4351 Stonehenge Way in Sacramento would have been tinder all over the neighborhood. And and he beat my ass. Right? He beat my ass. He beat my ass once when I got hit by a car. Probably was my fault, but he said I scared the shit out of him. And then he fucking spanked the shit out of me. Don't ever do that again. I'm like, okay. I get hit by a car, then I get spanked by my dad. I get spanked by my dad.
You didn't do it again, did you?
No, I looked both ways, man. Let me tell you what was traumatic about that whole thing was seeing my mother run. You know, girls didn't used to go to PE, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they wore blouses and skirts and played badminton. And my mom came running out of the neighbor's house. I almost like went into shock and like ceased all my vital functions because of watching my mother run. It was horrible. It was horrible.
Yeah.
Anyway, God, you know what? But let me tell you, I am what I am because of my mom. My dad was gone. You know, he was gone 6 months, 7 months, 8 months out of every year of my life. Kathleen was day on, stay on, man. She drove us across country. My love of reading comes from my mother. My intellectual curiosity was always encouraged by her. Okay. Yeah, and my mom is the reason I am like who I am. For better or for worse, it's her fault. So
I gotta chime in there. Mine, me too, because she was always willing to play Parcheesi, willing to listen to me tell the story of the latest book that I read, or, you know, and always pushing that stuff. I remember they got me when I was like, I guess 7 or 8, I started getting these companion libraries. Like they have Tom Sawyer on one side, Huckleberry Finn on the other. So, and how you knew you were done is it was upside down. The other book was upside down. You know what I mean?
Right.
So you had Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry Finn. You had 1001 Arabian Nights and then Sinbad the Sailor on the other side. You had Tale of Two Cities and then, Christmas Story. You know, that was that type of thing.
Wow.
It was like, yeah. So really, she was into it, you know, the kid wants to read, let's have him read, you know?
Right. I remember we used to do the Scholastic Book Club at my
– Yeah, that right? too.
I and, remember that.
Man, and I'll tell you what, I bought every – I bought every sports book, and I bought every book about World War II and Korea and Guadalcanal Diary, you know, Battle of Midway. That a whole series. I can see them in my head right now. They were red and then they had a picture of the battle on it. But my mom, you know, I'd come home and say, I want this book and this book and this book and this book. And she'd say, okay. She'd write a check for me in her impeccable penmanship. And, but the other thing was, you know, my mom, man, she was no fuck around when it came to me. Like when something went wrong, it was never anybody else's fault. She was not buying any of that shit. I remember, you know, my dad's a major league baseball player. Well, he might have still been in the minor leagues at the time. So I'm not older than 12. So yeah, so he's probably still in the minor leagues. So, but he's a professional baseball player, and he was a catcher. So I was a catcher. So I go, and I'm playing on my. I'm like 10 or 11, but I'm playing in major league, little league, right? I'm not playing in minor leagues with my peers because I was a pretty good baseball player. And so my coach drives a laundry delivery van. He doesn't know shit about baseball, okay? So, yeah, Ron Batson. And but he was a nice guy. And back then in little league, right, for whatever reason, everybody had a C bag. And that's what you put all your shit in, right? You put the bats in. You put the catcher's equipment in, right? You put everything and the helmets. I think we had one or two helmets, right? That was new technology, and they put it all in the sea bag, and that was like your gear. So we're practicing, and with runners on base, a catcher changes the position that he or she receives the ball in, right? You're not in that deep squat. You're up kind of, so your shoulders are over the tips of your toes and your knees so that you can catch and throw the ball quicker. So I'm doing that. And Mr. Batson looks at me and he says, I don't want you to do that. And I said, but that's the way you do it. And he said, I don't want you to move around like that because it confuses the pitcher. And I said, but Mr. Batson, when there's runners on base, and he said, I don't care. I want you to stay in squatting. And I remember I was pissed, right? So I get in the car after practice. My mom picks me up, and I've got the red ass, right? And she can tell, like, oh, he's got the fucking red ass. So she's sitting there smoking her cigarette, driving in our maroon Bonneville, which had air conditioning, which we had never had in the car before. And so we're pulling out of the parking lot, and she said, what's wrong with you? And I said, Mr. Batson doesn't know what he's talking about. And she said, what do you mean? I said, well, and I explained it to her, right? And she said, well, let me tell you what you're going to do. And I said, okay. She said, you're going to do exactly what Mr. Batson tells you to do. And I said, but Mom, that's not right. And Dad would tell me, and she looks at me, she goes, if you think your father would tell you to do something other than your coach told you to do, you don't know your father. And I'm going to tell you, you're either going to do what Mr. Batson says or you won't play. Right? What was the next words out of my mouth? Yes, ma'am. And she taught me about authority and responsibility and followership at that point. And she didn't allow me to be a punk-ass kid. Didn't allow me to be a punk-ass kid. So, yeah.
That in itself is a gift. Because I imagine as a kid of a major league baseball manager, you had a little bit more opportunities for weird special shit than the average kid did, and keeping a child grounded through that kind of turbulence, that's an accomplishment,
right? Right, and she did, she did. She was, but those are the gifts, right? That you're when you think back, like taking us to the libraries, because you know that's where we would go. You know, and I remember going to the library and I could stay there for hours. My sisters would be bitching to go home and I would be like, no, can we stay? And I'd be just sitting in that, you know, remember those round stools they would have in libraries? They had little wheels on them and you could step on them and shit. I would have one of those and I'd be in the military book section and I'd just be looking at pictures, right? The internet, That was your access to the internet back then. So,
National Geographic magazines. I remember looking at those too. Look, there's a bare-breasted woman.
I'm interested in this book. When we have the thing called the Dewey Decimal System, young man, and go and use it, find your book, and you could,
Right. You go over to the catalog and you grab one of those old catalog cards and a pencil or a pen and you'd find the book and you'd write the number down and then you'd go look. And then always the cool thing, and I heard we were talking earlier about Malcolm Gladwell, but Malcolm Gladwell said, I still will go, I'll pick a library and I'll go hang out there for a couple of days. And I'll go be looking at maybe a topic, but when I'm looking at that topic, I go left and right just to see adjacent, right, peripheral content. And I always find things that I grab and make a part of whatever I'm looking at. And it brought back great memories of, right, in the stacks of a library and then stumbling upon something that you didn't know was there, or like this is the German army on the Eastern Front. And you're like, I didn't really know anything about that. And you start looking at pictures and whatnot from the library.
Another.
Yeah. What's that?
One book leads to another.
Yeah, there you go. Great, great. Spoken like a true intellectual.
Oh, man.
I was explaining that at that leadership conference that Jeff and I were at, because we got put on a stage where the cadets could ask us questions. And I was explaining to them how this reading thing, how you start one place and you end up at another and get all these stories. But I slipped in a fucking when I was I ended with Stonewall Jackson. And I slipped a F-bomb in there. It was so damn casual that the cadets all caught it, but everybody else was like, "Ah, that's funny. That's cool." the only unfortunate use of that inappropriate speaking I did on Friday. But man, I do enjoy reading, and we're kind of unique in that respect. And that's I think that's why we hang out and talk sound interesting with each other. Yeah.
Should have used Rutherford's triangle of death. You would have never dropped that.
I know. I should have. I don't. I can't believe that just fell out there. But Stonewall Jackson was a weird fucking dude. I mean, that's just the only way to put it.
Hey, let me tell you. This is my opinion. When we're in the collective and it's a tribal event, to me, there's an element of legitimacy that comes with broadcasting on their frequency.
Yeah.
And stuffy old people maybe should get the fuck out of the room if they don't fucking like it. Because if you don't speak their language, if you don't broadcast, because let me just tell you, one of the things that, that I get all the fucking time about post-traumatic winning is when I walked up that day, I was so fucking pissed. And to think that I was going to have to sit through more of this shit and it was going to be 3 hours. Like, fuck, right? I didn't want to kill myself when I got up, but going to that made me want to kill myself. I mean, that's the shit that they say. Why? Because the people that produce content relative to mental health don't understand their audience, and they sure as fuck don't broadcast on their frequency. So, to me, there's an element of legitimacy that comes with profanity. Why? Because it's their language, right? Yeah,
it's exactly.
So anyway, if you won't go there, then that's fine. Get the fuck out of the room. Now, I will say this: when I did my thing last week for the key spouses of the Air Force, I did not use profanity. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that'd be grossly inappropriate in that form, though.
Right.
That's like common sense.
Well, again, you got to if you're not broadcasting on their frequency, then you're an idiot. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And I don't care if you won't go there, and I don't care where the frequency is on the frequency spectrum. If you won't go there to communicate to them, right, then fuck you. Then you're not serious about your idea and conveying your idea, because that's how they communicate.
That's the big problem with behavioral therapy and mental therapy, right? Because it's the type of people who would contract someone to do that don't have that behavioral problem that you're trying to solve. So it sounds good to them. the reasonable man approach, the therapy, you know, the therapist, the psychiatrist approach, the writer approach. You get somebody who just knows what he's talking about, and he's talking on the level of somebody who might be at that danger zone of the therapy, of the behavior trying to change. He doesn't sound as good as like the guy who's got six PhDs and stuff to a guy who's hiring him,
right?
Until you start seeing that it works, you know?
Yeah, and then it's, oh, holy shit. You know, and to just back that point up, I've had multiple sergeant majors come up to me to make that point. We, because we've outsourced mental health in the DOD, right, we now get yanked out of this tribe that we're a part of in the Marine Corps. And we get sent to go hang out, and the people that are going to fix us are these people that we've never hung out with in our lives, that we've never gone to a party with, and we won't ever go to a party with them. Now, they're the people that are going to fix us, which they say, and these are multiple sergeant majors, further fractures them, further yeah. tells them that you're broken. Instead of a staff sergeant sitting down with you and say, okay, motherfucker, what's your malfunction today? Right? That's all tribal language, which means I'm part of this, right? I have the same problems probably that everybody else, and now I've got somebody who cares about me that's going to talk to me and help me. Completely fucking different. And so to me, it's understanding the tribe, but you know what? Again, we hammer general officers only because they should be hammered, but until you can find general officers that will step in front of PhDs and say, yeah, I know it makes sense to you in egghead land, but the end user is a 22-year-old Lance Corporal, and that dog doesn't hunt in his world.
Hey, I think you're being too kind, because you're talking about these programs. They're designed by PhDs, but they're designed that the lowest common denominator of instructor that they're using can teach them. You see what I'm saying?
Well, let me tell you a personal experience about
that. Which is we're going to go ahead and roll out all this instruction. The eggheads aren't doing necessarily the instructing. They may in front of the general officers or something, but they've wrote a program, a script that the lowest common denominator of their instructor pool can take. And that's going to be determined by the amount of money in the contract, because you use so much money for a master's or so much money for a PhD. No, they're going to be rolling out programs that are going to be able to fund guys with maybe an associate's in counseling, that kind of guy. You see what I'm saying? I mean, that's how that shit works.
I'll give you a personal experience, and I won't name him by name because he's still on active duty. I do post-medic winning a year ago. And it wasn't nearly as good then as it is now. But anyway, that's beside the point. And a 4-star general in the Marine Corps comes up to me afterwards and said, that was awesome. He said, how do we distribute it, Mac? That's my question to you. And I said, well, if you're asking me how do we create a DVD and a script, you can't.
Yeah.
If you do that, it will just be another piece of shit period of instruction that will have no meaning. And he looked at me and goes, that's a problem. I said, yeah, Timmy did. Yeah, Timmy, it was like my head wanted to explode. I said, look, you need maybe a half a dozen guys to service the whole Marine Corps in a relatively short period of time. That's what you need. Okay. And again, there's probably products that you can make, but if you think everybody can convey this message and communicate this shit, then that goes to what exactly what you're saying to me. You want to know why programs fail? It's because of that mentality.
Right. That's exactly why. The thing is, it doesn't work. And I believe that the guys that are proponents of it would admit, well, yeah, it doesn't work, but it's something we can replicate and do that's within our financial constraints, blah, blah, blah,
right.
And which is not the point. Right. The point is we're talking about saving the lives of your Marines. I mean, for God's sakes, man.
Well, and so you're going to perpetuate a system that is giving us all these statistics, right? And that is this system. It's you generate programming that doesn't resonate with the end user. That they walk into the class that I give that says, I was so fucking pissed that I did everything I could not to go to. That's what you've done to entire DODY. Nobody says right, anything man. Else, right? And so you've sided with the PhD with this fucking monolithic system that doesn't speak to the end user, and you're part of the reason why the statistics continue to go up, and they continue to go up at an increasing rate. So get the fuck out of here.
And I want to say one other thing too, Mac, and that is that PhDs who develop their own businesses are not looking to have a business model that's contracted to what they personally can dedicate to the process. They're looking for a business model that expands, that they can grow, that they can generate wealth from, because what they're interested in is generating wealth, or they wouldn't be in that particular market space of selling and pimping out their research for mass consumption as a solution to a problem, despite the fact that the solution doesn't seem to be doing a damn thing. And that's the other side of that component. You know, it's infuriating to identify that as the problem, but I do believe that is the problem.
Well, the customer side, that's the contractor side. But the customer side is your bureaucracy. And the bureaucracy gets told there's a problem. And then that extrapolates to something must be done. And so this guy, PhD, comes on, something must be done. This is something, therefore we must do it, whether it makes sense or not. And you know, hey, if it's got PhD after it and stuff like that, yeah, we'll hire this. Rather than Mac has major retired after him, you know?
With all rights thereunto, you know, pertaining.
Yeah.
Right. Which is fucking none.
Yeah.
Okay, you guys were at the Marine Military Academy in Texas, and you guys want to talk about what you were doing there, and then we'll talk about they sent me some pretty cool pictures. One was a picture of the student body in front of the De Weldon statue. And I said, "Hey, where's Corporal Blockberry, Harlan Blockberry there?" So Jeff sent awesome pictures of his grave, and I thought, I got confused. I thought that Ira Hayes was buried there too. And where do either one of you know? This is trivia. This is military trivia, double jeopardy. Okay, where is Ira Hamilton Hayes buried?
I don't know. I'll flat out tell you.
That's embarrassing. Yeah, that's embarrassing. Guess.
I would guess the Pima Indian Reservation, but I hope it was Arlington National Cemetery.
All right. So which would you guess? Which would you – survey says?
I would guess the Pima. Guess the Pima.
Survey says?
I would guess the Pima Reservation.
Both you fucking fools would be wrong. Arlington National Cemetery, Section 34.
Good. I'm glad we're wrong.
Section 34.
That's good.
Units.
Well, he deserves to be. That's outstanding.
3rd Parachute Battalion, 2nd Battalion. 28th Marines and 1st Headquarters Battalion. Yeah, that's because he started doing like bond tours and shit like that. So anyway, explain, Jeff, explain what you were doing down there.
We were there for this leadership seminar, kind of like, and it was a one-day evolution. It started with two guest speakers. One was retired Major General Garza, Dave Garza,
right.
who gave a kind of an interactive speech about principles of leadership and principles of problem solving. And then after him was Josh Glover, a guy who had been in 1-5 for 3 tours, starting with OAF-1. And he did 2 tours after that, the one where they did the first Fallujah and then one in Ramadi. And then he became a MARSOC Marine, and he got wounded pretty bad in Afghanistan, up in the northeastern part of Afghanistan, and he was medically retired. His leg was just shot to hell, and so he talked to him about resiliency. He's a living example of that, physical and mental resiliency. And then after that, they did a panel, and Timmy kind of mentioned it earlier, where they had a first sergeant from the INI unit nearby, a sergeant major from another unit nearby, General Garza, me, Tim, and Josh, and a guy who had been in the Air Force in Vietnam, who was like he was a benefactor for the school, but he had started his own bank when he got out of Vietnam. Ooh. And he talked about, you know, lessons learned and stuff. So the kids first, Colonel Dowling queried us individually, you know, and then the kids were opened up and were able to talk to us. We did that for about an hour and a half or so. And then the last hour was we all had our own group, and we did we talked about articles that they had been assigned. Now, I had been assigned, it wasn't even really an article, it was something by General Cates, Clifton Cates, that basically referenced Chesty Puller, and it went into, I think it was the first time they ever codified the whole 14 leadership tricks into the JJ did tie buckle, you know, how we remembered it, and then the 14 principles of leadership. So I think what I do, my guys, I just sat around and I said, give me a good example of this, what's a good example of that, and try to, and because a lot of these youngsters, a lot of them are going to go into military service, I think, but a lot of them aren't. And a lot of the ones who are going to military service have been accepted in programs that aren't really geared towards Marine Corps. So they're into it, but their future is more eclectic than if you're talking to like people who are, you know, MESEPs or something like that. And then after that, we had lunch with them. We had breakfast to start out with, 06:30, 06:07. And then we ended with a lunch, and that was it. It was good. It was really good. And these are from 7th grade to 12th grade. So the kids are trying to answer questions from General Garza, this little interactive thing. And he'd give them a coin if they answered right. Matter of fact, even if they didn't answer right, he'd pretty much give them a coin. But he sees 12, like 9, you know, trying to answer the questions. It's kind of, you feel good, at least for me, I'm sure. I think, you know, I don't know how you felt about it, Tim. We both were enthusiastic when we got finished, for sure.
The I don't want to digress because at some point we're supposed to talk about Afghanistan, but I'm just curious when you talk about teaching leadership. You know, I think I've said this and we've talked about it a little bit before, but I'd like to just rehash it again. I remember General Zinni saying in that PME, we've got to stop, you know, teaching this, you know, Boy Scout type of leadership. You know, the great leaders of our military rarely had half of those, right? And the only person I know, this is General Zinni talking, saying something like, the only person I know that had all of them got crucified over 2,000 years ago, right? And he didn't say 2,000 at the time, in like 1900, almost 2,000 years ago. And so his reference to Christ. So I'm curious about when you get into that whole JJ tie buckle thing, how do you describe how they relate to being a leader,
Jeff? Well, for me, I'll let Tim talk. But for me, it was like, these are goals, you know, and you should always try your best to be perfect, but you'll never make it. But it's the whole thing about the Marine Corps, and I go to those hands reaching up of Ira Hayes, is you're trying to get there. You're trying to have perfect judgment. You're trying to have perfect, you know, senses of unselfishness and at the same time, humility to accept good ideas from, if they're good, from wherever they come from, and implement them. And the, of course, you can never be like Jesus, but we shouldn't not teach it, but we should put in the codicil that you'll never get there, but you always got to try. Some guys are just naturally blindly courageous. For most other people, it's a gut-wrenching, you know, thing that you got to force yourself into, because the one thing that unites all of us is fear of the whole thing being over, death. And that's and someone who defies that and does things that could result in an earlier death than, you know, the other guys, that's something to be admired, and it's usually followed. It's the easiest way to follow, as a matter of fact. It's easy to identify, but it's hard to actually do. So I think the point of it is to say these things are traits that great leaders have had. You should try to develop all of these because that's your job, to keep your people alive and accomplish the mission. But understand that it's an unreachable goal. You know, it's an unreachable goal. That's what I would say.
All right. Timmy?
I took a little bit of a different approach. And in fact, why I was bringing up Stonewall Jackson was specifically because it was a famous World War II general that, as far as leadership traits and principles, you could not find one of them evident in his behavior for most of his career. I mean, he was just a weird guy. And so my point to them was two. One was, in the military, it's a little bit easier to be a leader. And I said, it's easier. And the reason and also conversely, the reason we take it so seriously is because I can talk a good game and be like Mr. Leadership. But if I'm a battalion commander, if somebody, a peer or even subordinate officers, walk into your battalion, within 10 minutes, they can tell whether you're a leader or not, because it's obvious. It's so friggin' obvious in the conduct of the personnel underneath you and your command as to if you are an effective leader. You cannot bullshit anybody. That's the same thing with recruiting duty. That's why the Marine Corps is so places such value on recruiting station commanders, is because you can talk all you want to. You either make mission or you don't. And if you don't, there's an issue, right? So I took a different perspective, but I got to tell you, these kids were unusually bright and unusually well informed, and I kind of thought that those kind of schools were where they sent delinquents. And the biggest problem that chain of command the students have is how to motivate guys who aren't going to go with on the program. Because I told them, I said, the tools available to the Marine Corps military leader are not available to you. These students aren't here on UCMJ. They're paying money to be here. So we explored those avenues, and basically I told Chris, I said, you know, when they're complaining about these recalcitrant cadets, that's on you, bro. That's not on them. You guys have got to figure out what to do with them. They liked my answer as far as that one.
Yeah, you know, I was never big on the whole, you know, clean, reverent, obedient. I was never big on the whole list, you know. But I didn't hear Zinni till, you know, I was a captain, and it made sense to me. To me, you know, I think that, you know, you have to there. And I always say, and to include, you know, when I do post-traumatic winning, I just said it the other day in front of a whole bunch of Air Force staff NCOs. And I said, look, if you won't go here, because I talked about the effect of the cell phone, and I'll bring this back to being a leader or being the person in charge. This cell phone is supposed to be there to help us communicate, but in fact, it separates us. I said, so let me talk about from the end user, the people that we lead. Do you know that they're having less sex than we've ever had since we started recording that as teenagers? Sure. I said, how can that be, right? I can tell you from the perspective of a teenage boy, single-minded focus on the female frame and gaining access to that, okay? That's what my life was committed to as a teenager. I had seen the wonders of Pacific Beach in San Diego, right? And so how does that compute where we won't go up and dance with a girl? We won't, because we don't communicate, because we're afraid to interact in this world where it seems to be everybody's taking naked selfies of themselves, but nobody closes the deal. Like, what's going on with that? So you have this device that doesn't help us communicate, no matter what you think of it. And then from the leader end, we've taken this thing and we've created more distance from ourselves, because now, instead of having formations, we have a group text. We have the company chat window, right, where we send information out. Because we all know that was the only purpose that we had a formation, was to pass information, which is, in fact, not true. You had formations so you could get your eyes on them, see how they were doing, interact with them, meaning the gunny was busting everybody's balls, as were the staff sergeants, right? And you saw shit. Well, so the end result of this cell phone is that we're more distant from each other. And you want to know why they're taking their lives at a greater rate? I could tell you there's one thing. And the one guy I know who took a stand against that and said you will have two formations got shit on by the whole internet, okay? But guess what? That guy's suicide rate that went down 50%, and that's one of the fucking footnotes. And so to me, there's a big difference between, are you simply in charge of a unit, nominally in charge, or are you the leader? And let me tell you what a leader is. If you go around the military, especially the Marine Corps, there's monuments, right, from different countries. How did we get that shit? It's not like the Chamber of Commerce rolled out in the middle of combat and presented us with that mile marker from Way City. We stole that shit. Why did we steal that shit? Well, there was a first sergeant or a captain, company commander, who was smoking a cigarette and said, you know, first sergeant, that fucking mile marker would look awful good in front of the company CP back at Camp Lejeune. Right? And then they walked off and they finished. A week later, at about 3 a.m, a staff sergeant with a 6x and a hoist, right? And 6 Marines went out there and they stole that motherfucker. Why? Because they loved him. Because he was their leader. Because he took care of them. He gave a shit about them. And that's to me what leaders do. And I look and I said, if you won't lead in this realm of mental health, you're not a fucking leader. You are nominally in charge of a unit. Except I didn't use the F word. So to me, I don't know if everybody needs all those. And I agree with Jeff. Yeah, this is the ideal. But the one thing you need to have is integrity. Okay, you have to have integrity, and you've got to put the people you lead in front of you, and you've got to be good at your fucking job. Everything else, like, okay, endeavor to be those things, but these are the essentials. And so I kind of come down on where Zinni comes on. I mean, you guys are kind of the same way because we're all kind of the same plain-spoken, eyeball-to-eyeball leadership kind of guys.
Hey, I'll tell you something else, too. From that reserve outfit, that first sergeant and sergeant major that were down there, whoa, impressive, impressive guys, which enabled us to make the point to the cadets there. Now, look at this first sergeant and sergeant major. Do you think they're not players within the organizations that they're part of? I said, these guys are major players. And talking about the difference between ranks, because that was one of their questions about fraternization between the ranks. As far as staff, Marine Corps staff NCOs go, you couldn't have found two better. I've got very impressive guys.
Hey, Mac.
Yes.
Let me tell you something. This shocked me, right? The team that Meyer was on, when he got the Medal of Honor.
Yes.
Two guys get the Navy Cross. And I collected right after the thing happened. I stayed with those guys from that day for like another week and a half until we were able to reorganize and during that time we just reapportioned guys until we got replacements. Because they lost four guys killed and then, you know, another 3 wounded, too bad to ever come back. That's 8 guys out of 24. You know, they needed replacements. So and then wounded guys who did come back, but they trickled back, you know. But so one of the guys who got the Navy Cross is a drill instructor there, a retired Marine at that academy, Staff Sergeant Rodriguez Chavez. He was a Staff Sergeant then. He retired as a gunny. I was fucking overjoyed to see him. I couldn't believe it, you know. Last time I saw him was the Myers Medal of Honor ceremony when he was there the whole 3 days. The other guy who got the Navy Cross is Captain Fabio, who's a major now, I think. And then that led to the fact that those guys got what they got, and then Meyer buttonholing the president after the ceremony, and we're all meeting the president and saying, this guy, Will Swenson, an Army captain who was part of that group, he's the one who deserves a Medal of Honor. He ended up getting it. But it was great seeing Rodriguez Chavez, you know, because it was like I hadn't seen him since then. And we were pretty tight, 150. We went in there like 155 guys. We had 8 KIA, I think, and then about 25 wounded in the 9 months we were out there. But, it was great seeing him. And he's highly respected. And you can see he's glowing. You know, him and the other drill instructors, they got a great job and they know it, you know.
Interesting.
And serious-looking drill instructors too, man. I mean, these are not amateur-looking guys. Like you see at the ROTC guys with the big pot belly and shit like that, there's none of that. None. No, sir.
Now, to me, though, there's this – one of the things I've always loved about Marine Corps leadership when it's done right is there is this wire brush 1 second, and there's this incredibly, you know, I don't even know what the right words are, incredibly sensitive and – caring side to the best Marine leaders I've ever seen. And that's what makes him great leaders. That's why people will do anything they tell them to do. That's why they will steal anything, fight anybody, whatever they want. And I said, look, if you're a great leader and you say, I want the Home Depot sign in my front yard, that would look really cool. You be careful, because those motherfuckers at 3:30 in the morning, some Saturday morning, you're going to hear some shit, and you're going to have this crooked Home Depot sign in your fucking front yard, and you're going to hear them trying to wire it into your fuse box on your house. Right. Because that's what if you love them, because a lot of them come from backgrounds where they've never had that. They don't have people like these kind of leaders that really believe in them and empower them and tell them, no, I know you can do it. I believe in you. Go get it done. Right. And so I think it's the coolest part about the Marine Corps. Okay, now, fuck, we're supposed to talk about fucking Afghanistan. That's what these two fuckers are doing on here today, but we're screwing it up. All right, so let's transition. The document has been signed. What, Timmy, go first. Has anything changed for you relative to your thoughts on this? And John Bolton came out yesterday with some comments about this is an Obama-like retreat from Iraq. You want to address that?
Yeah, I will. I don't agree with John Bolton at all. I think this is a very good deal. As I pointed out, and for our listeners on Free Range International, I've already weighed in on it as soon as I heard about it yesterday. And as I've pointed out to you on this program, and as I point out in my writing, this is the only way it can end. It was always going to be this. The only question was how long it was going to take the USA to figure that out. So I'm very, very encouraged. The one thing that's jumped out to me that I did not know and was very concerned about was I thought our intentions were to leave a residual force behind in perpetuity, and that's not the deal at all. In 14 months we go, because I want to tell you something. We're not going to be able to do special operation raids around Afghanistan without the Afghanistan Kabul government being very closely involved, because the senior vice president-elect is Aminullah Shali, and he was the head of NDS and then the Ministry of the Interior for the last 10 years. He's worked with the JSOTF and CIA guys since the get-go. Yep. And he's on board with his comment about it is, I will beat the Taliban at the ballot box. So that says it all to me. The Afghans are down with this. It's time for us to go. And it looks within 14 months, we could be 100% out of there, which is what I've always believed would be the appropriate thing to do.
Wow. All right, Jeff.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'm glad he didn't mention it, but when we first started talking about this stuff, like last year, Tim brought up the most salient point about the whole thing lasting in perpetuity. He had said, right now we got we're paying their salaries until 2021. Once we stop paying their salaries, I think the game's over. Paying the salaries of the security force, over 300,000 guys. Now, if they make some kind of deal, and I would confess I'm ignorant on the details about this part, but if we continue to pay their salaries, they'll hang in there. If we don't, they won't. That's my belief. That's what happened in the early 90s when the when the Soviet Union folded up, the salary stopped being paid to the Afghan security force, and the president, Najibullah, was castrated, pulled out of the UN safe house and castrated. And, I think they can hang on as long as they have, as long as that's going, at least going, for a while. Now, whether Trump works out a deal that the other NATO nations are going to help pay them, because they're not being paid, they'll get outbid by the Taliban if that's the case.
So nothing's changed for us in terms of other than John Bolton's criticism, but we would still expect when they stop getting paid, this whole misadventure in creating a strong federal government will wither on the vine and go away. And then Afghanistan will recede back into tribal chiefs. They will control the major urban areas. The Taliban with its better way of adjudicating land disputes, will control the hinterland, and we'll see if they can peacefully coexist, politically coexist. And that's what so nothing's really changed. You know what? I don't see another way, right? At some point, they've got to either make a political deal or, you know, or we're not, as General Dunford said, we're not going to win this militarily. So, you know, what else do you do? What else do you do?
Investment. That's a sign of late 20th century ignorance. There are such a thing as unwinnable wars. There's no such thing as an unwinnable war, just like there's no such thing as an unwinnable game. But the idea is that we're not willing – he's right if he means we're not willing to put forth the effort and the resources, and we're just not – and we right. shouldn't be, you know?
So the notion that it is unwinnable is valid once you understand the constraints, yes?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. But we don't have the –
Yeah, no, if we wanted to, that's like saying, you know, the war is lost, Harry Reid. What? Like, with the resources the United States has? You know, that's Harry Reid, you know, contributing to the ISIS, right, and the al-Qaeda narrative in Iraq, you know, in 2006 for the sake of political gain. That fuck. But, right, but, I mean, everybody knew as soon as we have enough, boots on the ground there, the whole thing cools out. And it did, you know, and that was the frustrating part. But again, that was a Don Rumsfeld mistake, and it took us years to correct and blah, blah, fucking blah. But to me, you know, when you look at finding a way out of Afghanistan, you know, I think the slow realization is that our strategic interest is what? That al-Qaeda and ISIS or whoever comes after them will not be able to use it as a staging area. Yes?
Correct.
That is our
strategic interest.
That is. Hold on. Jeff, start over again because you're coming in garbled.
I don't think the safe space from which to launch terror attacks is a valid reason because, then where would we not be? you could launch terrorist attacks from anywhere. You know, I mean, I think that in the mind's eyes that they think Afghanistan is like a place where, hey, if you want to make a terrorist camp, just go ahead and put it up here. There's a lot of countries that are like that, you know, that it could happen.
So you don't buy that?
No, I just think that I
not only I agree with Jeff and completely about that. I don't buy that at all. I've never bought it, and I want to reiterate something that's an important distinction. And to the Afghan people, there were two wars. There was the war that overthrew the Taliban, and that ended in January of 2002, when the Taliban en masse surrendered to the Karzai government, started turning in their weapons and going home. Then we stayed around and decided we needed to throw a few of those Taliban who had cooperated with what Karzai had asked. They needed to spend some time at Gitmo because of the war on terror for reasons. And I've never been able to track down who and why that decision was made. And that was the second war. And that second war we're ending in worse situation than we were in January of 2002, when we should have just unasked the place and gotten the hell out of town. And I think it's important you remember, because you're going to hear all this graveyard of empires bullshit. And it's not the graveyard of empires. It's the graveyard of Afghans when the empires start moving around inside there, blindly lashing out, not knowing exactly what they're doing. That's who's the graveyard of.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, that's exactly right. I think that there's a lot of places that terrorist stuff can be launched from. But I think the broader cause for all this stuff is Islamic fundamentalism, which is a reaction to modernization that they hate it. And I mean, some of it I hate myself. But the modernization thing, the whole globalization thing, they're against that. It's destroying their culture. the Muslim, you know, the Islamic culture is being destroyed. And because it, some of the pillars of it are immoral. I mean, the way they treat women and stuff, the way that, you know, their outlooks towards different sects in Islam, you know, is like the whole Sunni Shia thing. It's just it's a culture that is outdated and they can't stand it. And that's why they flew those planes in our towers, basically.
Don't forget, after
they went to Vegas.
That's the ultimate
bullshit irony of the whole thing, right? That it's not about what we really believe and what we do. It's about this other fucking goofy thing. And so, to me, like all, you know, look, they're attempting to hold on to a feudal event.
I don't mean
futile, but that's what it will ultimately be. And you're watching it. But I will tell you this, the days of the Kuwaiti monarchy are numbered. The days of the Jordanian and the Saudi monarchies are numbered, because as more and more information flows into the hands of people, at some point you get pissed and you flip the whole thing. And the last thing I'll say is this. That culture, right, is going to have its own event, right? And what's going to be interesting to watch what the pressure put on American political leaders when women's rights start being compromised in Afghanistan. And our leaders have to look at everybody and say, the Afghans have to sort this out for themselves. And that's not going to play well in a liberal media, right, that, you know, whoever turns their back on the women of Afghanistan.
Hey, Matt, can I add that both you and Jeff are exactly right, but none of that anger towards modernity would mean shit unless Saudi Arabia was funding that stuff, unless there were people in the Gulf that were given the money to make this war against modernity, if you will, and none of that money came out of Afghanistan, and none of that damn money came out of Iraq. And that's what infuriates me the most, is we've never addressed the fundamental issue here, and that shit's flowing out of Saudi Arabia.
It's not just that. It's like Al-Qaeda equals Saudi Arabia, Hezbollah equals Iran. You know?
Exactly.
And they're there. They push that because, to a certain extent, especially with Europeans, it works. You know, with us, not so much. We're, you know, we're always looking for another Pearl Harbor to find an excuse. Tally-ho against somebody, you know. So that's the wall they finally ran up against. And so the idea of pulling out after all this time, as long as I think we can keep them going, as long as we're paying their salaries or at least some of it.
No, that's Jeff. I'll tell you what. That, I mean, I think one of the things that people have enjoyed is, you know, your guys's, you know, out and about experience. You know, and the truth you bring to this commentary, which is exactly that. You know, what is going to be missed when the United States unasses that thing? American dollars. That's what's going to be missed, right?
Exactly.
America forcing their way on Afghans won't be missed one fucking bit. And they'll go back to the way they've done things. And the way they do things is going to piss a lot of Americans off. And so the question that will be, but again, there is no other solution. There is no other solution. And the fool's errand, you know, that we went on when we tried to create a strong federal government and a strong national military, things that have never existed in the history of the son of a bitch, right, you know, is now going to come to a close. And so I like you, Timmy. I disagree with John Bolton. I see him as different issues. And if John Bolton has a way – you know, short of what Jeff's saying, sure, we can go ahead and win it, but we got to stay there for 150 years, and we got to have about 200,000 Marines or American military members or NATO members, and nobody's willing to pay that price for that piece of shit.
No, because you did it in Helmand. You locked down half the Helmand. It was quite an impressive feat, but it was expensive as shit. And that was the problem.
And unsustainable. And worse, unsustainable. Because they won't sustain it. And that, and Jeff has made that point repeatedly. At some point, they got to fucking fight for it. We've given them more training, more money, more assets, tried to create an air force for them, right? Yeah. All in vain. At some point, right, you got to fight for yourself.
Hey, man, and there's another part of this that's going to be a tough pill to swallow, and that is, as I kind of jokingly said last time, they're going to have to issue these Taliban guys passports. In August, if everything works out, at that point they've lifted the international travel ban on Taliban guys, which means that Siraj Haqqani is going to get a chance to go to Dubai. And if you ran a damn radio station worth a shit, Mac, you'd have the money to fly me there so we could do an interview with him.
Yeah, but this thing's not worth it. This thing's not worth a shit, so don't worry about it.
No, I know. I see that as a joke, but in actuality, that's not funny because Sarojini Nakani's been at the top of the J-pill for 10 years. That's guys that we've gone after time and time and lost people trying to get, and they're going to walk free and be flying all over the world. That's going to be a bitter pill for us to swallow, but that's the price we got to pay.
Yeah, well, what I said, I wasn't joking, though, just for the record.
No, I know. I was. I don't want to go back to Dubai.
All right. Jeff?
Well, I think it could last if we continue to support them in their own effort as far as paying salaries until we can fawn it off on the Germans, you know, or at least split the pain of this thing so we're not doing the whole thing. And I think, like you identified.
Okay, so let me ask you. So Jeff, what would be the point of doing that?
To keep them going so that we can take advantage of intelligence resources and stuff in there from there. Because okay. the we were talking, you know, Hezbollah equals Iran, Al Qaeda equals Saudi Arabia, but a large part of the Muslim reaction to modernity and stuff equals Pakistan, and Pakistan's issues they have with India and everything, it could be a conflagration. And so I think it's good to keep an intel hand in that. So if like that guy, what was the guy's name again, Timmy? The guy who owns who's the
Somalia.
He's that guy's MOI, okay, Ministry of Interior. He controls all the cops. That means he's tied in with the on the border with the with the Pakistanis. Same thing with the MOD guys, the Ministry of Defense. They're going to be tied in with their counterparts. We can get stuff going. And then there's military innovations we could do in Afghanistan with actual assets, but we're in and out to like support them. Like say Lashkargah is threatened by a force that's not even bothering to do it in a counterinsurgency way. They're coming at them like, conventional. You know, we could practice all kind of horrific shit to do to those guys in support of the Afghans without even, being there for more than 12 hours. And then if it's successful and we can shape the thing so it would be, that's something the rest of the world's going to see. So people who are looking at screwing around in Mexico, me and Timmy were talking at this thing in McAllen or in Harlingen, that's probably the next one of these things going to be on this side of the pond. And it's going to be something around Mexico,
non-state actors.
Yeah, right. Non-state actors threatening safety of American citizens in a big way. So that type of thing sends messages that cause people to spend money, which they can't use to work up operations against us.
But again, to me, the problem is that, we're a pretty powerful nation. But when we attempt to do nation building, I mean, the lesson of Vietnam, the lesson of all these other places is, but if for us to stay off coast and to whack the shit at a bad non-state actors, to go in, right, and to jump the 82nd Airborne or the 101st into some place, yoke somebody's ass up, and then leave, maybe the Rangers might have been a better choice of words right there, then so be it. Right. And then leave. We're not interested in you can rebuild your country. We'll just tell you what we won't tolerate. And so to me, right, the lesson of Vietnam was understanding the limits of American military power and you had guys, Tommy Franks, and the Air Force dude who turned their backs on a war that they fucking fought in, which the more I think about it, the more it just makes my head explode. The seminal lesson that comes out of Vietnam is don't do this shit. And they fucking did it, right? And they will be judged forever in Valhalla with a fucking go clean the shitter's fucking job up there. You know, yeah. Fucking bullshit. And so, but I can see us, you know, off the coast or, you know, we have long legs, right? We could go in and we can whack people. We can support that. We don't even have to fucking claim we did it. What? Yeah, we don't know what you're talking about.
See, and if we don't do that, the Chinese will say, because they look at things different. They'll go, we don't really want Afghanistan, but we want, like, we want some of the minerals they got there. So they pay a guy like Dostum to run, you know, the Uzbek section of Afghanistan there, because that's where their copper mines are or whatever. You know what I'm saying? Right. They'll cherry, and it'll be to their advantage. So, you know, I'd say we should do it because most of the Afghans would rather, you know, I mean, we talked about a little bit, I think, last week. Most of them now, they know things they never knew before 2001. I mean, they kind of knew it from the Russians coming in. But now they know the good part of what the West can bring. And they'll never be able to go back again. You know, kind of like what you said, the last thing those guys did before they flew the airplanes and they went to a strip club, they enjoyed a little bit of the, you know, the naughty side of the good part of the West.
Right.
But now, guys know the other parts too. They know about cell phones. They got cell phones. They got computers. They got the internet. It's not. They're not going to be able to go back the way they were without a different type of internal struggle than they're used to, i.e. murdering each other over the goat herds, you know?
And you know something else too, guys? You know who else has not learned the lesson of Vietnam? Turkey. Turkey's learning that lesson right now.
Oh, shit.
China's going to get it. China's going to have a dose of that too. As I mean, they're trying to control the lithium mine in Mexico. They've been trying to get that copper mine in Logman province, actually is where it's at, in Afghanistan. And go ahead, China, go ahead and try to pull your bullshit there with the Afghans and watch how you bleed when they get pissed at you. Because I'm telling you, it's not easy. We screw it up all the time, but we make it look like it might be easy. Then Turkey and all these other countries, they'll lash out and grab a piece of dirt, and all of a sudden they're getting the shit hammered out of them, and they can't figure that out.
I have to tell you, though, I had a smile on my face when I read that headline. And again, what's horrible about it is, you know, the original death count I saw was 33 Turkish soldiers killed. Those guys are just like us. They grew up. They're proud to be Turkish. They're fighting for Turkey. Blah 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 blah. And they got used and abused by government, right? That doesn't give a shit about them. And the death toll will go north of that. The Russians, they fucking denied, right? How do you know the Russians are lying? Because their lips are moving, right? Yeah, we had no idea. What? Are you sure that wasn't ground fire? Well, we don't know what you're talking about. The Russians. So the Russians think they can play all 18 sides against the middle and get away with that shit, which is interesting. So it was fun. It was interesting to see them choke on it as well. But again, as you just said, Timmy, those son of a bitches who think that you're going to – look, you haven't learned the lesson that you should have learned, right, which is to be very careful lest you be drawn into something that you're not going to be able to extricate yourself from and that you don't know how it's going to end. And that, to me, is what Turkey has done to itself. And they are going to create – and this is my prediction, right? This is my international affairs prediction, right? Turkey is going to light off a civil war because the things that they're fucking around with don't go back into the jar easily. So
yeah, that's right.
That's my take. That's my take on that shit. All right. Any final thoughts about Afghans? So we think Afghans going to turn into what we said it's going to turn into for months, and that is it will go back to the way it was. And
I don't think the Taliban are going to. I think the Taliban will keep the peace at least for the next 14 months. And after that, you're still in a situation where they don't have enough combat power to overthrow the Kabul government, and you're back to the Hatfield and McCoy's kind of standoff. There's going to be problems. There's going to be points of friction. There's going to be some gunplay, but I think it's going to hold out.
Yeah, me too.
Well, so do you think – so and I don't – if there's gunplay, again, now here's the political side of this. Donald Trump's going to go in front of the American people and say, I ended that war, right? Oh, so yeah. It's going to take a pretty large gun event to stop this.
Well, and, if Americans are involved.
Right, I agree. But it's going to take a big event because of the political, right, the political, you know, stakes – mm-hmm. Right on the table. And so he's going to say, look, you know, do you want me to go back in there and to do what? To sacrifice more American lives? And so to me, that's the difficult part. The other difficult part is going to be the media part, which is when the burqas go back on in Kabul and Kandahar and wherever, and Afghan women start screaming, right? And that a liberal American media is going to say, what do we do to the people? We abandoned them.
Okay. Like, can I make a comment on there, Matt?
Yeah, go ahead.
You can't, the burqas are not going to go back on in Kabul. They're not going to go back on in Herat or Mazar Sharif. They are going to go back on in Kandahar, and they are going to go back on in Jalalabad, but that's the local women making that decision. That's the local people's decision. I can promise you this. Kabul will not go back to the burqa. Nor will Herat.
Yeah. Wait, what'd you say, Jeff?
It's mostly Pashtun culture.
Got it. Yeah, but again, true. I mean, but you know how that will play in the United States, right? You know what Western media will do with that story.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it just depends. It seems like so often these days they develop stories that are designed to stoke outrage, such as the Afghan papers that fall out to be duds because nobody's paying attention or gives a damn. I'm not too sure how my fellow residents in McAllen feel about the plight of females in Uruzgan province of Afghanistan. I'm pretty sure their concern is about zero, and I think that's where it's going to remain.
God.
Yeah, no one believes them. That's the problem for them.
That's true.
All right. Any final thoughts before we adjourn this cerebral event?
I think I will offer on behalf of Jeff and my hand myself the hand of friendship as we welcome you aboard the Trump train as once again our president pulls another rabbit right out of the hat. Buddy, we are never going to remind you of the times in the past when you doubted the worthiness of the commander-in-chief.
No, I've never, ever doubted, like, some of his policy stuff. But
I know. It just cracks me up to even say that. But
tell everybody why your wife likes me.
I'm sorry, say that one more time, Matt.
Tell everybody why your wife likes me.
Oh, yeah, my wife loves you because my wife hates Donald. He's the orange turd to her. There's nothing he can do that will ever redeem himself.
And I don't hate the president. She loves you. But I do think, you know, we need to slow your roll as you at the altar of the Trump. I mean, come on, man.
My call me names on the radio. I think I deserve that.
All right. All right, boys. Thank you very much for the visit. So, again, just to summarize, you know, as you would expect, pretty consistent. Bolton's not right. I think Jeff's comment is spot on. You know, that could we win Afghanistan? Absolutely, we could. Do you want to be there for 100 years and have, you know, 150,000 American and NATO troops there? Is the nation willing to do that? And if you're willing to do that and create generational change, then we can absolutely do it. But nobody wants to pay that price. So what's the next course of action? We've attempted to do, I think, by any standard, what a nation that endeavored down a road that it shouldn't have gone on and then tried to bail itself out. You know, it has been our best effort and the lives of, you know, thousands and thousands and the body parts and the sanity of many more thousands and thousands of young Americans. And, you know, I mean, I think at the end of the day, you know, we tried as best we could. And I believe that both Jeff and Tim are right when they say when the money runs out, Everybody will go seek a new source of money that will be a local source, and then the Afghans will go back to what is equilibrium for their city states, and this fictitious federal government will go away. So I think that summarizes it there very well. So I'm happy with myself. All right. Thank you very much, man. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.